This is an ABC podcast.
100,000 troops are right now on Russia's border with Ukraine. Tanks are doing exercises. World leaders are worried. You're probably asking, are we about to see some kind of war break out? The thing is, there's already a war underway and it's been going on for years. G'day, Dave Marchese with you on Hack, and we're going to break this down for you. You'll be hearing a lot more about it in the news. So what is going on in Ukraine? Also coming up, workers' rights. What are you entitled to during the pandemic?
Hack.
The might of the Russian army on display in its ally Belarus, Ukraine's northern neighbour, as Moscow also builds up troops on Ukraine's eastern border.
On Triple J.
Ukraine, it's a country on Russia's border and right now the centre of the world's attention. That's because Western powers think Russia, the largest country in the world, is about to invade. They're building up troops and artillery on the border with Ukraine, doing military exercises and generally being pretty threatening. But Russia insists it's not up to anything. The US isn't convinced, though. It's threatening to retaliate if Russia invades, and now this desperate diplomatic attempt is underway to try to sort the situation out. But how did we get here? Serge Negus takes a look.
That's the sound of two young men, university students, being killed by a sniper in the middle of Ukraine's capital, Kiev, in 2014. If you've been wondering what the hell is going on between Russia and Ukraine at the moment, this is kind of the start of it, at least in recent memory. Ukraine is a country in Eastern Europe which was part of the Russian Empire for centuries before gaining independence after the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991. After losing its Russian imperial legacy, the country started to move towards the West, aligning itself more with Europe. But then, in 2014, a decision by Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych to reject an agreement with the European Union in favour of closer ties with Moscow led to deadly mass protests, which eventually saw Yanukovych removed as leader and exiled to Russia. This then kicked off a war that has continued ever since, seeing Russia invade and take control of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula.
What America is officially calling a Russian invasion of Ukraine.
We cannot stand by when the sovereignty and territorial integrity of a nation is flagrantly violated. If that happens without consequence in Ukraine, it could happen to any nation gathered here today.
Moscow then threw its weight, that is, money and weapons, behind a rebellion of Ukrainians who support Russia living close to the border between the two countries.
This is amateur video of a burning passenger jet, the wreckage of Malaysian Airlines MH17.
You might remember when nearly 300 people died, including 38 Australians, after Russian-backed separatists shot down a passenger plane over the country. Russia has denied any responsibility. Since the war started, more than 14,000 people have died in fighting that's devastated Ukraine.
I was 14 years old when this happened. I remember I was celebrating my father's birthday and this was when I heard the first bombs. Yeah, so my name is Anastasia Kovalova and I am from Lugansk, which is now the city that's controlled and occupied by Russia. And I am 22 years old.
Yeah, so Anastasia's home city in the war-torn Donbass region of eastern Ukraine is essentially the epicenter of the war that's been raging in the country since 2014. It's also where Russia has now started to amass troops on the border. That looks a lot like they're planning a full-scale invasion. Despite sending around 100,000 troops to the border, Russia has denied that they are planning an invasion of Ukraine.
Personally, I feel scared and frustrated and also lost. My family and I, we went through this whole nightmare in 2014. So personally, I do feel scared of my family to go through the same steps, through the same nightmare all over again. I just asked my dad yesterday, do we have a plan in case the invasion will happen?
We've been going through this for 8 years almost now, and you know, the Western media says like, oh, Russia is going to invade Ukraine without actually mentioning then, well, it already had invaded Ukraine.
This is 22-year-old Julia Timoshenko. She's from Kiev.
People in Kiev are feeling worried because more and more troops are moved to Ukraine, Russia and Belarus border, which is essentially 2-3 hours from Kiev. I myself had a conversation with my family, which was kind of bizarre, just like after a dinner of my father's birthday, discussing where would we go in the western part of Ukraine if there is a threat to Kyiv, and how would we evacuate?
Julia says that Russia has been at this kind of thing for years.
And I personally believe that the Soviet Union and Russian Empire should be treated as a colonial state when it comes to its impact on Eastern Europe and the world. It has tried to erase national minorities and ethnic groups around its territory that it's acquired. It has tried to prohibit the language, the native languages.
Despite the risk of invasion, Julia's found hope in the young people of Ukraine.
And I do feel like Ukrainian youth have been amazing on social media, online, doing a bunch of stuff to help people who have been affected directly by war, trying to carry the voices of Ukrainian people around the world and just reviving, I guess, the culture that has been oppressed for so many years under Russian regime.
But the country has been divided between people who see Ukraine as part of Europe and those who see it as Russian. Despite this clear division, Anastasia thinks that most young Ukrainians want the country to be part of Europe.
The people who want to be with Russia are the minority, whereas people who would like to live in the civilized society where democracy is the key are the majority of people.
While the situation is looking pretty grim right now, Julia and Anastasia hope that there's a diplomatic solution and that it's all just Russian President Vladimir Putin flexing his muscle.
I just hope that it's just, some sort of mental game that he's playing with, like, the entirety of Ukrainian people and the West.
So I would like to see the future in Ukraine more bright, where people are not afraid and people are free to do what they want, and where there is no war.
Hack on Triple J.
Serge Negus there, and on the text line, Mo from Melbourne, you say, I'm a bit worried that a war will be started not by Biden or Putin, but by faceless war hawks egging on for action. Yeah, it's anyone's guess what'll happen next. It's pretty complicated. As you can tell, there's a long history. Someone, though, who can help fill in more of the blanks is Dr. Alexei Muravyov from Curtin University. He's an expert in national security and strategic studies. Dr. Muravyov, thanks so much for your time.
Afternoon.
Now, we've just heard a bit of the long history of tensions between Russia and Ukraine, but why have things taken a dramatic turn now?
Look, I mean, it's important to put things in the perspective. Yes, it seems like, especially with following media reporting, that it's all about Ukraine. But the reality is Ukraine has just become the problem hotspot in much broader and more complicated string of things involving great power behavior, great power contest, and great power rivalry. And in this context, we're talking about the competition between the United States and Russia. And Ukraine has just ended up being this zone of what especially is described as proxy conflict, where the interests of great powers simply collude, and it has become a visible front line in the ongoing state of this confrontation between the nuclear superpowers. So whilst it seems like everything and all the eyes are on Ukraine, but Ukraine has just a segment of much broader power play that the two major centers of influence are contesting for, and it's about strategic stability in Europe, it's about global balance of power, and Ukraine may end up their tipping point, which may turn things around in the favor either of the United States or in Russia. That's why it has become so contested.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting, and we're starting to see now that there are so many different interests that are coming into play. We're talking about alliances, and we'll speak about that a bit later. But some experts are saying that, Russia may invade. Russia's claiming it's not planning to invade Ukraine. Do you think that there will be an invasion?
Look, I mean, it's important to recognize two points. One, whether Russia is ready to invade, and at this point in time, if you take military political perspective, it's not. It doesn't have sufficient invasion force to overcome Ukrainian defenses, because we're talking about or media reports about over 127,000 Russian troops massed along the Ukrainian border in parts of Belarus. But we also should not forget that half of the Ukrainian army, and it's about 125,000 troops, are massed in eastern parts of Ukraine, and now more are arriving to the border with Belarus. So for Russia to overcome Ukrainian resistance, it needs a little bit more firepower, even though It deploys technologically advanced forces. So militarily, Russia is not ready, but it may be ready to do it in a week's time, in a few weeks' time. However, there is also a political and economic side of things attached to it. Russia has just completed the construction of a major pipeline that connects it with Germany called Nord Stream pipeline. It wants the pipeline to start working, and obviously it recognizes that should it invade Ukraine, this project, a strategic long-term economic project, is likely to be canned. Russia is continuously engaged in political discussions with the United States, with Europe, over the strategic stability issues that I mentioned to you earlier. So commencing hostilities and times when negotiations are taking place and continue is simply madness. So there are a number of factors that point out, whilst it may seem that the Russians are massing forces on the border in Ukraine or in Belarus, and they may be poised for invasion, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they would cross the boundary. And there is one more element that's important to recognize. Russia uses the Russia factor. It's a bit of a kind of, you know, double mixed here as a form of justification, because the controlled the areas of eastern Ukraine that are currently controlled by pro-Russia separatists have undergone through the phase of acquiring Russian citizenship. So there are about 650,000 Russian nationals who currently reside in Ukraine on the territory not controlled by the officials in Kyiv. So the Russians, in theory, can justify the actions by simply defending the lives and well-being of their nationals, and that further complicates the issue of this whole situation. So there is multitude of layers. There are multitude of pros and cons for Russia going in or not going in. So that doesn't help to clarify the picture. But at this point in time, I would probably argue that Russia would probably want to use intimidation techniques in order to gain advantage in its discussions and negotiations with the West, rather than gain territorial gains, since it already accumulated parts of Ukrainian territory since 2014.
Well, I guess the discussions that are happening and the attention that's been focused on this situation and the concern that it's generated, in many ways, the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin, has kind of succeeded in that intimidation, I would think.
Yes, it has. And in fact, Russia has now advantage in terms of running negotiations. Russia has advantage of actually keeping Western Europe, the United States, and certainly Ukraine on its edge, because the Russians are not, whilst the Russians are kind of denying the fact that they want to invade Ukraine, they also say, yes, we're not going to invade, but there is a set of conditions under which we may be compelled to use force reluctantly, but it doesn't help the Ukrainians. In this sense, so Putin certainly knows what he is doing, and when some political leaders describe him as irrational or someone who doesn't know what he is doing because of his age and because of his personal insecurities, well, that's actually a false impression. Putin calculates everything very carefully and quite cannily, and certainly what he is doing with regards to Ukraine. Again, it's less about Ukraine, more about great power politics, and Ukraine just happens to be this proxy area. But he knows how to go about it, and he knows when to stop. And at the end of the day, if Russia will not end up invading Ukraine, they will use it to the advantage by simply saying, look, I mean, all this media hysteria that, you know, the allegations of us invading Ukraine has created went nothing. But in fact, that in itself works in Putin's favor, because the current media storm about Russia's alleged imminent invasion is doing more damage to Ukraine's economy right now than possible actions of Russian military in the future.
Wow. Well, one of the real concerns for Russia is that Ukraine will join NATO. NATO is a military alliance of European countries as well as the US and Canada. Can you explain what Moscow is so worried about with that?
Well, since World War II, the Soviet Union and Russia was worried about what security and defense experts describe as buffer zone, effectively a territorial strip or the capacity to make decisions in type of heightened tension as confrontation. The whole logic of the Soviet Union controlling Central and Eastern Europe throughout the Cold War was to keep its boundaries safe and have a distance between them and their peer adversaries. So when the Soviet Union collapsed and when the Soviets withdrew their forces from Central and Eastern Europe, they began feeling more and more insecure because NATO, which was created to contain the Soviet Union and to deter the Soviet Union during the Cold War, began moving into its former sphere of influence. So by 2020, 2021, Russia ended up with remains of its former buffer zone represented in the form of two principal states. One is Belarus, which Russia managed to keep under its influence, including following the support of Lukashenko's regime last year, and now Ukraine. So should Ukraine go, that remains of the buffer that gives Russians a peace of mind and makes them feel more or less insecure will be gone, which would enhance their sense of insecurity, and that would itself cause further deterioration in global stability, because if the Russians would feel insecure and if they would misinterpret the actions of their geopolitical adversaries, they may launch preemptive strike, and that's not a good thing when it comes to nuclear superpower.
Look, there's so much to unpack, and it's so interesting, but it's great to be able to get that insight. Dr. Alexei Muravyov, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
On the text line, lots of people with their comments. Someone saying there's a good documentary on Netflix on this called Winter on Fire. Highly recommend. Another person says that guy has an awesome perspective. Not wrong.
Hack. I wasn't working full time throughout most of the pandemic, so I've been on JobKeeper for a bit, and then when that finished off, I applied for JobSeeker.
On Triple J.
Yeah, earlier this week we spoke to some young people about how hard it can be to access financial support when you're out of work because of COVID, whether it's figuring out complicated applications, waiting a long time for it to be processed, or anything else. It's not easy. We've also been hit up by people saying they're confused about their rights at work. Maybe this is you. Have you been forced back to work when you should be isolating? Or maybe you were on annual leave when you got COVID and wasted your hard-earned time off and you didn't know what your rights were there. Let me know. Call in 1300 055 36 or message 0439 757 555. So what are your rights when you're impacted by COVID? Thomas Costa from Unions New South Wales is on the line right now, and I suspect he has some idea. Thomas, thanks for your time.
No problem. Glad to be here.
Now, you guys have put together a bit of an online explainer with some frequently asked questions from young workers. Why have you done this?
Yeah, look, I do want to acknowledge that there are any listeners that are feeling confused or anxious about keeping up to date with COVID-related rules about work. They really aren't alone. We have been receiving a large number of calls from people asking questions about their rights at work due to COVID. And the truth is that the rules around COVID do keep changing, and it is hard to keep up to track and hard to get clear and concise information, which is the main reason why we decided to put together an online fact sheet to assist workers in finding clear and correct information.
Now, one of the big questions we get, Thomas, from a lot of people I've heard it, is if I'm on annual leave, if I'm on holidays, I've got some time off, and then I get COVID in the middle of that, can I convert that to sick leave? What's the answer?
It is a very common question, and the answer is yes, you can. You have the same right to access sick leave whether you're on annual leave or whether you're at work. And so it really is as simple as asking for sick leave the same way you would normally when you're at work. So contacting your employer if you're required to get a medical certificate, getting that certificate, and then you can have that annual leave converted into sick leave. Of course, that is if you're entitled to paid sick leave, and we know that casual workers, for example, don't get paid sick leave.
Yeah, a lot of people may not be eligible, but a lot of other questions we have are from workers who are saying, what about if I feel like I'm being forced into work, if I'm sick or if I should be isolating? What are the rules around that?
No employer can force you to work if you're sick, and particularly if you're sick with COVID. You do need to isolate if you test positive to COVID or are sick with COVID for at least 7 days. If you're forced to isolate because you're a close contact, however, the rules are a little bit more complicated. And we know previously close contacts had to isolate. Now close contacts who are critical workers can still be required to go to work as long as they're continuing to test negative. And the definition of critical worker does change. At the moment, it's quite large, includes a number of different types of workers such as health workers, different types of transport workers and manufacturing workers. So we are asking people, check with your union or check with your employer to make sure, you know, if you're unsure about whether you're a critical worker or not.
What are the consequences for employers, bosses who aren't doing the right thing?
So in terms of if an employer is forcing you to go to work when you're sick, there are serious consequences. They're breaching public health orders. Employees who are put into that situation really do need to get in contact with their union. They do have the right to refuse to go to work if it would be unsafe to do so. So if you're an employee, for example, being asked to go to work and you know there are other people there who are infected with COVID, have tested positive for COVID or sick with COVID, you really should not be going to that workplace. You need to contact either your local health and safety representative, your union delegate, or the relevant.
There are probably a lot of people out there thinking, look, I won't rock the boat. I don't want to upset my boss. What would be your advice to those people?
We are very concerned, particularly for casual workers in that situation, because they don't have access to paid sick leave, for example. And we are concerned that a lot of casual workers will feel pressured to go to work for financial reasons and may do so if they're infected with COVID or feeling unwell. And what we are saying to those workers is, you know, please contact your union first if you are being pressured. If you're not in a union, please contact the relevant regulator or the Fair Work Ombudsman and talk to them so that you know what your rights are. We are going through a global pandemic now. These are very, very risky situations and people need to be across their rights and they need to enforce those rights where they can.
Yeah, and I guess there's obviously the financial implications for young workers, but I'm sure it takes a mental toll as well. And you're probably hearing a lot from young workers who are saying that it's just mentally really exhausting and stressful as well.
Yeah, we are. And it is very exhausting, particularly, you know, we're in the third year now of this and the rules do keep changing. We are advising people that, you know, you just need to be very much across your rights and obligations. Join your union if you're not a union member, because they can take a lot of the stress out of understanding this, dealing on your behalf with your employer in tricky situations, and also advocating for other rights for you, including pay rises and other things, and making sure, you know, your workplace is safe.
All right. Thomas Costa from Unions New South Wales, thanks so much for your time.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Hack.
The notion that we have at the moment is that patients will and should come to us in our brick and mortar hospitals and structures.
On Triple J.
Yeah, well, I'm sure you've heard we've got a new Australian of the Year. Grace Tame has passed the baton onto Paralympian disability advocate, former Triple J favourite, Dylan Alcott. And you may have also heard that we've got a new Young Australian of the Year, Dr. Daniel Knorr. He's 26, but he's already helped more people than most do in a lifetime. He had an experience in London a few years ago that prompted him to get back to Australia and set up Streetside Medics. It's a medical service for people who might be vulnerable and experiencing homelessness. It's an amazing initiative and I can't wait to hear more. Dr. Daniel Knorr is with us now. G'day, Daniel. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Dave. I appreciate it.
You must be so stoked. Obviously, everyone's stoked to learn about this huge thing that you've created. What happened to you in London that made you think, hold on, there's a huge issue with services available to people experiencing homelessness and needing some help, some medical treatment?
Yeah, as you touched on, Dave, it was an interaction with a gentleman when I walked out of a train station. Initially, I walked out of the train station thinking it's a musician or a busker because there was a crowd around one person. But I, on approaching, quickly realized it was actually someone having a seizure. And so, you know, at that stage, I was a final year medical student. And so I did my ABCs. I kept him safe. I kept him stable. And paramedics took him away. And after that, I had a conversation with some of his friends, of whom many were also experiencing homelessness, and they were surrounding me. And there was one lady in particular who was driving that conversation. She was sort of, you know, I'd say mid-40s or 50s Caucasian lady. And she was saying this particular gentleman was having seizures for months, but it often occurred a few streets away in an alleyway where not too many people had noticed. And so I asked her why he hadn't gone to see a doctor, why he hadn't gone to see a GP or go to the emergency department. And she laughed when I asked her that question. And For context, I've grown up admiring the healthcare system. My brother was a patient from a young age. He's doing quite well now, but I always grew up admiring the healthcare system and I was so curious why. And what I learned from her was that they have this genuine sense that potentially the healthcare system doesn't care enough about them, or that they would be judged based on prior histories or their current social determinants, but also that it was just too difficult to be able to see a doctor. And, you know, in the UK, they have the NHS system, which is very different to Australia. And so when I came back to Australia, I did my research and I was hoping to see that this wasn't an issue at all. But what I learned was we do have the best healthcare system in the entire world, but we also share the same challenging barriers which limited access to healthcare. And as a result of that, the health outcomes for those that are experiencing homelessness are less than ideal. And prior to that, I'd been volunteering many years for a food service called COCOS. And I always was curious as to medically what was going on with this cohort. And I recognized during those voluntary years that healthcare wasn't always a top priority for them. Things like food and shelter and companionship took a much higher, you know, priority to them than their healthcare. And connecting the dots and looking at the list of barriers, it was quite obvious to me. We have this, I guess, notion as doctors that when a patient's sick, they come to us. They come to us in our medical center, they come to us in our hospital, they come to us in our brick and mortar structures. That's evidently ineffective and extremely ineffective for people who are experiencing homelessness, and they suffer in silence. And it killed me. I seriously could not sleep at night knowing that there were people on our streets that were living with conditions that I had the knowledge and the how of how to treat, but it just wasn't being done. And that's when Streetside Medics was born. It was time we took the service to them.
Well, you did do that. You did do something. You couldn't sleep at night. You had an idea. You set up Streetside Medics. Can you explain what it is, like how it works? You've obviously, because you have a full-time job too. You work as a doctor full-time in Sydney. And then after you finish work, you go and volunteer with this organisation you've set up. But obviously there must be a lot more others who are helping as well.
Yeah, correct. So how it works, it's a van. The van is custom built as a medical center with two separate stations, a medical support officer station, so a junior doctor or a nurse, and a GP station. Inside the van, we have a range of equipment, pathology tests, so we can get blood test results in a few minutes. We've got an ECG, an ultrasound, a spirometry machine, an otoscope, ophthalmoscope. We've got a small pharmacy. We've got a vaccine fridge. So a patient can come in and get a lot done. But the way it works is we take that van to a food service, like a soup kitchen or a shelter. Hundreds are lining up to get food, the common denominator that we all need. We all need food to survive. As they're lining up to get food, one of our volunteers will approach them, build a relationship with them, build some rapport, and then offer them the service and tell them the capabilities of the service, but also that the service is free. There's no need for Medicare. There's no need for ID. And onto your point, this, when it started, it was just me and one person, another GP, volunteering. Now we have a team of 250 selfless and dedicated volunteers, including over 100 doctors and many GPs who dedicate their time to the service after work. But after my work as much as I can, but it's grown so much bigger than me. And that's, I guess, the biggest pride of it is the fact that the service is now taking its own legs and growing. And I want to use this opportunity to do a call for action for anyone out there that is a general practitioner, a doctor, a nurse, an allied health professional, for any corporates out there. Streetside Medics needs to grow and become a national service. And the reason I say that is 116,000 people experiencing homelessness across 8 of our most beautiful states in Australia. Many of them have the same barriers that limit their access to healthcare. And as a result of that, their health outcomes are less than ideal, and we need to change that, and we can change that. The fact is we know how to do it. The proof of concept is there. It works. Outcomes are better when they come to a service like Streetside Medics. And I'd encourage anyone who can help us, please, to reach out and help.
I'm sure there'll be so many people who are hoping to help. And just quickly, Dr. Daniel Knorr, Young Australian of the Year, obviously a huge honour. How does it feel? What are you hoping to achieve?
Look, it's a challenge for me because, as you said, I work full time. So the main priority here is to grow Streetside Medics into a national service for us to be able to access 116,000 people. But, you know, in terms of how it feels for me personally, it's an immense sense of pride, but it's also it's also goes to show, you know, the old saying by Confucius, those who say they can and those who say they can't are both right. As a young 20-something-year-old, I doubted my ability to do so. But I had people who believed in me, who pushed me along, and I had to believe in myself.
Well, you've done well. And Dr. Daniel Knorr, we're so happy to have had you on the program. Thank you very much for your time. And that's all we've got time for on the Hack Podcast for now. I'll catch you later.